But now on BBC Radio 4, the fascinating story of an English eccentric. His broadcasts from France of dance music on Sundays transformed the wireless. Les Woodland tells the tale of the first pirate.
This is the port town of Fécamp on the Normandy coast of France, and it's the site of a sort of revolution in broadcasting history. Because back in the early 1930s, a man called Captain Leonard Frank Plug, an English eccentric, stopped here for a cup of coffee while he was driving down to southern France. And it was here that he began Radio Normandy, the first pirate radio station broadcasting to Britain. Before Luxembourg, 30 or 40 years before Radio Caroline. It was the first station which really challenged the BBC, especially in the amount of music that it broadcast, and especially on Sundays. And it was that that broke the heart of the BBC's founder, Lord Reith, who eventually left, and by his own confession, was never as happy again. This is the story of Captain Leonard Plug, the first pirate.
Radio Normandy calling you, bringing you music from out the blue, the northern rivers await you here. You know it stands for Radio Normandy coming through, with love and enjoyment for all. So be sure you listen in to Radio Normandy calling.
The signature tune of the radio station for which Captain Plug is most remembered, or rather, not remembered. For the story of this remarkable man is sadly neglected. Radio Normandy was perhaps Captain Plug's finest, but by no means only, achievement. For this was a man who invented a radio telephone for cars, who claimed to have invented something called television glasses, who worked as a scientific researcher for the RAF, which is where his title comes from. He was an engineer for the London Underground, and he even became MP for Chatham, a man of many talents. His son Frank has his middle name. He also has the family photograph album.
And what's that say? This is a spanner.
That's a dead man's spanner.
And what does it say on this? Souvenir of?
A souvenir from the superintendent of the line to Captain L.F. Plug, who drove the first train on the Underground Railways during the general strike of May 1926. Meant endear him to a trade unionist, I guess, say. But
a letter from the French ambassador.
Service approval and view of it. Where he's being awarded the Order of the
Chevalier
de Légion d'honneur.
Which is as close as you can get in France to a knighthood.
Yeah, he's at the lowest grade. He always said, I think I should be upgraded because I'm only a chevalier, which actually means knight. It's become a commandeur.
Which, for a man with a yacht at Cannes and a house at Hyde Park and a passion for theatrical types and dancing girls and the general toffery of life, would have been the least he would settle for.
What sort of man do you remember your father as being?
Well, very difficult father.
How?
Well, all his children found him difficult. I mean, he wasn't really like a father to us because he was never around. We used to live in separate houses and he'd pretend he was living there. So if he wanted to bring some friends round, he would arrive and introduce his family as if we were, he was living there and everything else, and so as if we were on parade, he expected us to all come down, sit down, be polite and meet his friends, and then he'd go off and we wouldn't see him again for 3 weeks. I remember my sister, which is a rather poignant thing, once saying to me, and she said, I wish we had a proper daddy, when she was about five or six, something like that. I wish we had a proper daddy.
That sister, Gail, ended up joining a black revolutionary group and was murdered by its leader, Michael X. The house they shared, or didn't share, with their father was used as the location for that dark film performance with Mick Jagger and James Fox. Nothing about Captain Plug's life was ever ordinary or straightforward, not even his name.
It's a piratical name, Captain Plug. He couldn't have been better named for what he did. Was he that by nature? Did he revel in overturning the...
Well, he wasn't Captain Plug in those days. He was Captain Pluger. Because it's a Dutch name, and that's what he was known as. He only started being called Plug when he stood for Parliament, and one of his pamphlets or posters said, Plug in with Plug for Chatham, or something corny like that. And I think it came about because of that.
Coincidentally, Frank once lived in a place called Caroline Hall.
Curious, considering his father paved the way for another pirate station of the same name. So how did he come to have a radio station on the coast of France that on a good day had more listeners than the BBC?
Well, I mean, he was a driving pioneer to start with. I mean, he did trips across Europe, which had never been done before. You know, Bucharest and back in 1926, go over the Dragoman Pass being dragged by oxen. I mean, with six female school teachers on board, I mean, that's pretty eccentric, isn't it?
I also think it needs more explanation.
Well, he was at that time experimenting with radio reception. Could you get the BBC in various places, stopping at capitals where there were radio stations and meeting people and that sort of thing? It was, the purpose of it really was to do with broadcasting.
The man was so dotty about broadcasting, he'd drive round foreign radio stations and get their schedules and sell them to the BBC to print in a magazine rather similar to Radio Times. But it didn't stop there. When Captain Plug decided to listen to the radio in his car, he did it the big way. Car radios were all but unheard of at the time, and Plug's only worked because he had half a hundredweight of batteries welded to the chassis and a loudspeaker hanging from the roof like a lampshade. A big car, you see. He parked this car in the West End of London one day and stepped out feeling very proud of himself. And all the people going by, it was such a thing to hear voices and music and who knows what else coming from inside a car, that they stopped and gathered round in such numbers that Plug was arrested, taken off to court, and fined for causing an obstruction. So this was the man who pitched up one day among the seagulls and grey roofs of Fécamp, a fishing port south of Dieppe.
Fécamp came about because he had this idea of broadcasting commercially from the continent. As you couldn't, there was no commercial broadcasting in Britain, BBC had the monopoly. He thought, well, why don't I go out to some French station and rent some time and broadcast to them? And he went out to Normandy, and he was sitting in a cafe, and there was a music program with a bit of chat, I suppose, like a modern program. And he said to the owner, what is this program? He said, oh, that is Radio Fécamp. And he said, who owns it? Oh, it's Monsieur Le Grand. He's the big chateau there. He makes the Grand Monnier. He said, well, I'd like to meet Mr. Le Grand. So I believe he went and saw Mr. Le Grand, whose radio station was in fact kept under the piano, sort of three or four heavy boxes of kit. And I think he used to just turn it on and let it run, and then intersperse every half an hour with some talk, I think.
The story is taken up by the man who, for years and years, has lived the life of Captain Plug. His biographer, Keith Wallace.
Le Grand told Plug that one evening he was broadcasting and he mentioned the name of a friend of his who was a shoemaker in Le Havre and what good shoes he made, and sales increased enormously. Of course, Plug's ears pricked up at this and thought, wonderful, this is just what I'm looking for, a commercial radio station. And so he thought, well, I'd better do something, and he rushed off down to Le Havre to buy some gramophone records. And before he could buy them, he had to go and get some money. So he went to the English bank in Le Havre, the National Provincial, and to draw his money to buy some records, and drew some money. And while he was there, he was talking to the teller, and he said, do you happen to know of anybody who be prepared to go to Fécamp on a Sunday evening and put on a few gramophone records? So the chap said, oh, he said, yes, he said, I'd be rather interested in doing that myself. I've got a motorbike and I could, you know, drop over there and do it for you. So his name was William Evelyn Kingwell. And he was really the first disc jockey. He was certainly the first disc jockey from Radio Normandy. And he carried on for a few weeks until Max Denifer arrived.
I was desperate for a job. And I answered an advertisement in the Daily Telegraph from Captain Plug, and I went and saw him, and the result was that I got the job of running Radio Normandy. He sent me over there with instructions to do more or less what I thought best with a box of records. I would go to the microphone and announce that here was IBC now starting its nightly transmission for listeners in England. And I would say straight away, we are starting off our programme tonight with the popular foxtrot, Life is Just a Bowl of Cherries, or whatever it was. And off we went.
Life is just a bowl of cherries. Don't be so serious. Life's too mysterious.
It wasn't long before Radio Normandy had built a sizeable audience, particularly on Sundays when, as Keith Wallace explains, the BBC provided rather weak opposition.
People were pretty fed up with Reith's attitude towards Sunday broadcasting. And the Sunday broadcasting consisted of serious talks or church services or something like that, and they weren't allowed to play any dance music. And people didn't want to listen to that all day. So as soon as Normandy started, they were able to tune in to some dance music on a Sunday, and it was super, you know, something different, and they could relax to it. And this is why it was so popular, and it gained in strength tremendously.
This is Radio Normandy broadcasting on its new wavelength of 274 meters.
Purcell presents Purcell Personalities, intimate broadcast by the great stars of our time. All this week, Purcell tops the bill with Vinnie Hale, musical comedy's brightest star. With Peter York and his music. And ladies and gentlemen, I have the great pleasure of being your announcer, Dennis O'Neill. Before we start, a word about washing day.
Radio Normandy calling you, bringing you music from out the blue. The modern rhythms await you here. You know it stands for Radio Normandy coming through. With love and enjoyment for all. So be sure you listen in to Radio Normandy.
The important thing Plug wanted to find out, IBC needed to know about Radio Normandy, is could they sell anything? They know they had an audience, but could they actually sell something over the air? And Plug got together with his partner, co-director George Shanks of IBC, and they got together in the kitchen of George Shanks's mother's house, and they found a recipe for face cream, and they got a saucepan and the ingredients, and they mix this up, and they put it in little black pots. And they sent it over to Max Staniforth in Normandy and said, advertise and sell this. This was called Renus Beauty Cream.
Here is a very interesting announcement for everyone, more especially for our lady listeners. Renus Cream is made from the finest and purest vegetable materials obtainable. By its gentle, soothing action, it softens, nourishes, and beautifies the skin, while during the day, it forms a perfect foundation for powder and rouge. Right to classic beauty preparations of 10 Great Stanhope Street, Park Lane, London West 1, enclosing 2 shillings and threepence in stamped postal order or cheque, and you will receive a delightful jar of Renus Skin Food.
And from that, they did sell a lot. In fact, they sold so much that they had to employ an industrial chemist to take over the manufacture of this Renus body cream. It's half a crown pot, in a little black pot with the gold ladies on it. But it proved the point, and he was able to prove to the future sponsors and advertisers that he could sell over the radio.
Which would have horrified Lord Reith as much as dance music on Sundays. This isn't the place to be rude about the BBC's founder, but I think it's fair to say he wouldn't have been your first choice for a mate down at the pub. A bit on the serious side, Lord Reith.
He would have liked to have seen my father in prison.
Why?
Well, I think Lord Reith thought it was his God-given right to be the only broadcaster of the airwaves.
Well, Reith felt he had very strong views on what should be broadcast and what shouldn't be broadcast, particularly on a Sunday. To him, Sunday was the day of rest, the day when he went to church services, and the thought that somebody should be polluting his broadcasting area with dance music on a Sunday. That's only in a Sunday evening to begin with. He didn't think that was right. And therefore, he didn't like Plug for that reason. I think it was more the reason. I don't think he was quite so concerned about the competitiveness only for that particular day. I mean, it didn't really compete with the BBC during the week. It was only on a Sunday when the audience had something else to listen to.
Hello, everybody. This is Roy Plumley speaking. I hope you're spending a happy weekend and that the programs you're hearing from Radio Normandy are contributing to your happiness. What better start to a day could you have than the infectious cheerfulness of Browning and Starr?
We want to be happy, but we won't be happy till we make you happy too.
And now here's a signature tune that will be the prelude to a whole heap of future entertainment.
How we doing? Hey, hey, sweet, 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 but what? How we doing? Hey, hey, oh, baby, oh, sure. Now we may not be the best in town,
but we'll be the best of the best comes out.
How we doing? Hey, hey, sweet, 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 but what?
How you doing? You're doing pretty well, girls. This is Roy Plumley speaking. Write to me, care of the International Broadcasting Company, 37 Portland Place, London, West 1.
The best story I ever heard about Roy Plumley goes right against that wonderful voice of dinner jackets and patent leather shoes. The Plumley family income, I love this, the Plumley family income used to come from selling washable condoms called The Workman's Friend. But did you notice that address? Portland Place, right next to the BBC. Staff from the Beeb and the Tearaways from Plug's IBC used to drink at neighbouring pubs in a back street, exchanging insults. Reith, in his wood-panelled boardroom overlooking the street, saw memos cross his desk suggesting the government jam Radio Normandy. Reith wouldn't agree, although more and more he wished that when Plumley closed down Radio Normandy every night, he was closing it down for good.
And now the International Broadcasting Company's transmission is drawing to a close. For those of you who are keeping watch on board the ships of the seven seas, fair winds and a good passage. To those of you who man the lightships on our sea-washed shores, may your night proceed peacefully, immune from fog. To bakers and newspaper workers, to young mothers who tend their darling little ones, to those who are rising to ashore the early morning ships, may your day of toil be fruitful. And to the rest of you, especially those who may be sick or suffering, good night and happy dreams.
Good night. Good night. Just a kiss. May you fade from my sight.
Plug really was instrumental to a great extent in forcing the BBC, John Reith, in other words, into putting light dance music on his radio stations on a Sunday. Prior to that, prior to Plug, they couldn't do this. He wouldn't have, it had to all be serious stuff on a Sunday and nothing light and so forth. So, yes, you could say Plug was probably responsible for the BBC lightening their programmes on a Sunday, and I believe they did start broadcasting some dance music in the evenings.
Keeping up the pressure, Plug's radio station invented IBC orchestras and IBC studios that never existed and created a fantasy on the air. After a while, it set up a mobile recording van to visit the circus or music halls. And then its presenters would say, "We take you now to such and such a theatre where the show is just beginning." And then they'd play the recording. At least once, they were caught out, not least for broadcasting a live show 2 weeks after the theatre had burnt down. What Plug couldn't do, because the British Post Office wouldn't give him the high-quality telephone lines that he needed, was broadcast dance bands live from their ballrooms, as the BBC did. And it was hard to be convincing when all that was available were 78 RPM records. That's when Plug showed his genius. He bought rows of 35mm cinema cameras and recorded the bands on their soundtracks. The quality was so startling that his broadcasters could suggest the world's best dance bands were playing live, Even the BBC was fooled. But Plug feared the BBC, the Post Office and British Customs would gang up to intercept his programmes. So instead of sending them direct to Fécamp, he sent them to a record shop in Paris. A clerk there was paid to spot the parcels, something the owner knew nothing about, and take them to Poste Parisien, another Plug station. Poste Parisien took their own programmes out of the pile and put the rest on the train to Fécamp. That sort of enterprise and a chain of continental radio station interests couldn't fail to make Plug wealthy.
Well, he told me after the war, and this was, he told me, so 1950, he said, before the war I was earning 1,000 a week, and so 50,000 a year. Now, in those days, that was fairly big money, but he would spend it all. I mean, we lived in a house with between 10 and 15 servants, and if you count gardeners and chauffeurs and everything.
And a yacht in Cannes, I think.
We did have a yacht, too. It did not have gold taps, as some newspapers say. The gold plating era came later. We had a private cinema. It had 50 seats, projection room with professional projectors, a bar, just like a normal cinema, with 50 seats.
He was really a social climber, if anything. And he loved to be in with the important people, to meet the important people. He couldn't be bothered with people who were not important. And he tended to... He held parties at Hamilton Place, and he invited kings and queens, and if they were very big parties. We have reports of them and who were actually present at the parties.
Literally kings and queens?
Literally kings and queens. A king of Spain, I think, he had to one of his parties.
It all came to an end with the war. Roy Plumley always said he left from a boat on the beach as the Germans were entering the other end of Fécamp. The Germans took over the studios. By then, Plug saw his destiny as running not merely a radio station, but the country. He was MP for Chatham in Kent from 1935 until he lost his seat in the Attlee landslide in 1945. I asked Medway Conservatives if they could tell me anything about him. They didn't reply. I can only think he didn't make too much of an impression, because the only comment I could turn up was from another MP, who dismissed him as a windbag. He lived on, though, in the eccentric glory which formed his life. Trixie Neuberger met him in her days on the Sunday Pictorial.
One of the reporters, Madeleine McLaughlin, lived at Dolphin Square, and she said to me one day, "You must come and meet one of my neighbours, Captain Lenny Plug." And so we went along there with another reporter and met this gentleman, who was a most extraordinary man.
In what way?
Well, the thing I remember most clearly was the series of ropes he had by his bed, which he would pull from bed, presumably, to put on the light, to put on the heating, to put on what was then black and white telly, put on the radio. I can't remember whether it was to put on the oven and turn it off or not, but you know, I could well believe it might be. And I suppose this is the first and a very early example of remote control.
Plug died in 1980 in California. He was 92. It seems so unfair that so few people remember him. Here, anyway. Maybe things are different in Fécamp.
Well, this is where he came in all those years ago. This is the Place Thiers in Fécamp, or as they now call it, the Place Général de Gaulle. And in front of me is a big statue to the fallen of the World War. And there ought to be a statue of General de Gaulle, I suppose, and there's not. There really ought to be a statue, if they knew their history here, to Leonard Plug himself. But of him, absolutely no sign. I've been looking for the Café de Colonne, which is where he met the man who told him about the radio station. That too has gone. But across the road is the Société Générale, and that used to be the Café de Colonne, and it was there that history started with Radio Normandy.
Excusez-moi de vous déranger. Nous sommes de la BBC en Angleterre, oui. De la radio BBC. Oui. Nous faisons ici un programme qui s'agit un Capitaine Plug. Vous le connaissez?
Non.
Somebody ought to remember him.
Jean-Marc.
but nobody does.
Monsieur.
Which is odd. I mean, if some rich foreigner had turned up in your town before the war and churned out pop music so loud that it could be heard all the way to the French Midlands, at the very least, you'd think people would mention it now and then. But not in Fécamp, they don't. I tried to find someone who could tell me if the building which housed the Radio Normandy studios was still standing. I tried the Grand Marnier factory, I tried the Café des Sports, I tried the tourist office. But nothing. In these circumstances in France, there is only one thing to do. Have lunch. And after that, I went to the public library. They surely would help me find whatever remained of Radio Normandy. Three cheers for the ratepayers of Fécamp. An Englishman walking in to ask about odd moments of the town's history isn't such a common experience that it wouldn't involve first one, then two, and finally most of the library's staff. Eventually, they produced a photograph and some simple directions.
Eureka, we've got it. One of the great things about going on a great hunt is that quite often you end up back where you started. And I shouldn't think we're more than about 50 metres from the Benedictine distillery, which is where we started part of our search. And we're in the Rue de Boulogne, which is where they said his house would be. And I'm armed with the picture. It's a house of, well, a rather grand townhouse with little turrets and Dutch-style roofs coming down and tall, thin windows. But looking around the top of the road, there's one of those typical rather drab cement French buildings of no great distinction at all. There's quite a nice house alongside it, which looked almost as though it could be the gatehouse for this big original building. And then below, nothing at all. There are some women talking up there. I wonder if we can catch them up and ask whether they recognise this house or not. Bonjour, madame. No, restez là.
Non,
vous pouvez nous aider si possible. Nous sommes de la BBC en Angleterre. Nous faisons un programme qui s'agit Radio Normandie. It's always a sad story that comes to an end without a proper conclusion. And I think that this one is going to, because this house in this picture here, I'm convinced now, doesn't exist. All the houses in this road were built since the war. I've just asked, confirmed that. So I think sometime rather in that period, this wonderful house was knocked down. I suspect it stands where that rather monstrosity of a house there, the cement house, stands. It's in plenty of grounds. It would be just right for that size of building. It's no longer there. And I think the history of Radio Normandie, the history of Captain Plug, and the history to an extent of that little bit of time of Fécamp have all gone in that pile of bricks and rubble.
Good night.
The First Pirate was presented by Les Woodland. It was produced in Birmingham by Brian King.